This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 22, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast,
we proved that we are still a people capable of doing big things.
Lawmakers passed the massive health care reform bill in the House.
32 million more Americans having access to health care, $1.3 trillion saved for the taxpayer, and accountability for the insurance companies.
We'll take a look at the contentious vote and what's next. Tens of thousands converge on the National Mall to call for immigration reform. And in Iraq, coalitions vie for power as challenges to the outcome of this month's election continue. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke today to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, the nation's largest pro-Israel lobby. Clinton reaffirmed U.S. commitment to Israel. She went on to explain the U.S. reaction to Israel's recent announcement of 1,600 new settlement homes in East Jerusalem.
It is our devotion to this outcome, two states for two peoples, secure and at peace, that led us to condemn the announcement of plans for new construction in East Jerusalem. This was not about wounded pride, nor is it a judgment on the final status of Jerusalem, which is an issue to be settled at the negotiating table. This is about getting to the table.
She also clearly reiterated U.S. demands for Hamas.
Our message to Hamas is clear. Renounce violence, recognize Israel, and abide by previous signed agreements.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also speaks to the lobbying group today. He meets with Secretary of State Clinton and Vice President Biden as well, and is set to talk with President Obama tomorrow. Meanwhile, along the Gaza-Egypt border, Israeli warplanes raided an underground tunnel. No injuries were reported, and Israeli media say that Gaza-based armed factions resumed firing homemade rockets into nearby Israeli areas. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rami Al-Maghari is in Gaza. He brings us more.
Over the weekend, the Israeli army killed four Palestinians in separate incidents in the West Bank. Recently, Palestinians have stepped up protests over Israeli settlement plans in occupied East Jerusalem, which Palestinians consider the capital of a future Palestinian state. In Gaza, Hamas downplayed a visit by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who is in the region, to encourage all parties to resume peace talks. The UN has assisted in reconstruction efforts in Gaza following the January 2009 Israeli war. Afasaran asked the Secretary General what prevents the repatriation of many thousands of Gazans displaced by the war.
That is exactly what I have been working and very hard and urging Israeli authorities to ease crossings so that all humanitarian materials can be shipped into Gaza so that this reconstruction can be continue.
Rami Al-Maghari, Afasaran, Gaza.
The U.S. Supreme Court today let stand a lower court decision that prevents federal judges from stopping transfers of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. It's a win for federal authorities, allowing them to move detainees when and where they choose. District court judges remain unable to step in if a detainee objects to his transfer. Also today, the court left in place local restrictions on anti-choice protesters outside of clinics. And justices refused to hear two other cases as well, one on the federal government's role in stopping Asian carp in Lake Michigan, another on former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega's bid to avoid extradition to France. The High Court did, however, agree to hear a new case. They will consider the culpability of the New Orleans prosecutor's office in a case that resulted in the wrongful conviction of a man who was exonerated after 18 years in prison. Also in Washington, Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee withdrew hundreds of amendments to a financial reform bill today, clearing the way for a vote. The move avoids extended debate in the committee, and if it passes, the measure could make its way to the full Senate in a few weeks. The bill rewrites financial regulations intended to prevent another market meltdown. Six Mexican farmers opposed to the construction of a dam were gunned down over the weekend on their way home from a protest. Shannon Young has the story.
The victims belong to a movement of small farmers displaced by the Picachos Dam project in the state of Sinaloa. They had marched to the state capitol, erected a protest encampment inside the state legislature, and were on their way home when their pickup truck was riddled with bullets. All six passengers were killed. According to police, the farmer's pickup got caught in the crossfire of a shootout between two convoys of criminals. Three other bodies were also found along the highway murder scene. The farmers' movement has been carrying out a series of protests for more than a year now, demanding the government pay a fair price for their expropriated land. They have faced evictions, beatings, tear gassings, and arrests by state and federal police. Some of those displaced by the Picachos Dam marched through the state capital of Culiacan yesterday, accusing the state government of having a hand in the murders. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
A lesbian youth is in a Mississippi court today challenging her school's decision to cancel prom after she asked for permission to escort her girlfriend to the dance and to wear a tuxedo. The school district defended the cancellation of the April 2nd event, saying the issue was too much of a distraction. The ACLU is representing Constance McMillan in her bid to force officials to reinstate the dance at the school. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Doran Marina in New York. After a long and intense weekend, the House of Representatives passed health care reform. In what could be described as a monumental feat, the legislation is expected to provide insurance coverage for more than 30 million uninsured Americans. The president is expected to sign it into law Tuesday. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The House of Representatives was teeming with energy this weekend. In a rare weekend session, Democrats scuttled to and from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office as she and her fellow leaders worked long hours to secure the votes for health care reform. She succeeded, and with a few votes to spare. The House passed health care with 219 votes. 34 Democrats joined all Republicans in opposition. Most of the opposing Democrats came from conservative districts. Regardless of the close vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hailed the bill as monumental.
Enabling people to have the freedom to have life, a healthier life, to have the liberty to pursue their own happiness. They could change jobs without losing health care.
But Republicans see the bill in a different way. Republican leader John Boehner.
Ask yourself, do you really believe that if you like the health plan that you have, that you can keep it? No, you can't.
Republicans fed off the energy of Tea Party activists that rallied on the lawn outside the Capitol building, holding signs that read, "Kill the bill." Some Republican lawmakers encouraged and led chants from the balcony just off the House chamber. Activists outside turned nasty as they yelled sexual slurs at Representative Barney Frank. They yelled the N-word at civil rights leader Representative John Lewis and spat on Representative Emmanuel Cleaver. But the tide turned for Democrats late Sunday afternoon after an agreement was reached on abortion. The president said he would sign an executive order codifying current law that no federal dollars will pay for abortions. A number of anti-abortion Democrats then signed on to the bill, including their leader, Bart Stupak of Michigan. Stupak says the executive order ensures there is no expansion or limitation of current law.
There was concerns in this legislation that the conscience clause, that those who might have religious or moral objections, or a facility run by, say, the Catholic Health Association, would somehow be co-opted or their values be lessened underneath this healthcare legislation. The president makes it very clear the conscience clause will always be available and it will be in force of law.
But neither anti-abortion nor pro-choice groups are pleased. The Catholic bishops are still opposed, and women's choice group NARAL says the provision that makes women buy a separate rider to cover abortions will actually limit choice. The bill will also prohibit undocumented immigrants from purchasing private health insurance, and lawful immigrants will have to wait 5 years before applying for Medicaid. It mandates that people buy health insurance and that most employers provide it. While it will be the largest expansion of health insurance, some call it the largest subsidy to health insurance companies ever. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Leanne is joining us now to talk about next steps because the process is not yet over. Part of this legislation goes back to the Senate. What can we expect?
The part of the process where the House passed the so-called fixes to the Senate bill, that's what goes back to the Senate and is under the reconciliation process. The changes will provide more generous subsidies for low-income people, and they'll expand Medicaid, as well as ease the tax burden for people with high-cost insurance plan. So the fixes were necessary in order for the House to pass the less appetizing Senate bill, and a deal was made that the Senate would go ahead and agree to those changes.
So how much longer do we expect this to drag out?
The debate will begin after the president signs the health care bill into law on Tuesday. Then the Senate will open up, will take up the reconciliation package and begin debate. You're likely to see what's called a vote-a-rama. That's where a number of amendments, an unlimited number of amendments to try to alter the bill can be offered. We can expect Republicans to offer an immense amount of amendments, and Republicans are also expected to raise procedural challenges at this point.
So could the Democrats try to change the bill, perhaps include the public option?
They could, but Democratic leadership is strongly advising against any amendment to alter the bill on the Democratic side, including the public option, even despite its overwhelming support in the Senate. And finally, Dorian, after this bill is done, there's likely to be a vote in the Senate. People are thinking by the end of the week, by Friday. Some states are also drafting measures challenging this mandate that forces people to purchase insurance. So once it leaves the Congress, it could and is signed into law, it could go to the state legislatures next.
That's FSRN's D.C. editor Leanne Caldwell. Thanks, Leanne.
Thank you, Dorian.
Also in Washington this weekend, tens of thousands gathered on the National Mall to demand that Congress keep sight of another priority, immigration reform. People from across the country came to D.C. to express their frustration that President Obama failed to fulfill his promise to reform the immigration system his first year in office. Tanya Snyder was at the rally and brings us this report.
Organizers estimate 200,000 people participated in the march to push for comprehensive immigration reform, chartering nearly 1,000 buses from all across the country.
They had raffles. They sold T-shirts. They did everything they could to buy a plane ticket, to be here this day on March 21st, because they wanted to make sure that they were counted, that their voice was counted.
Angelica Salas directs CHIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. She and other leaders met with President Obama 2 weeks ago to push him to stop the raids and deportations and work for reform. Obama replied that his administration was only deporting criminals.
I told the president that he was, frankly, you know, with all due respect, Mr. President, you're very wrong. The people that you are deporting are good people, are people who are hardworking, are people who are students who should be in the finest universities of this nation. That's who you're deporting. They're not criminals. And there has to be a change in the law in order for good people to stay.
In fact, immigration-related prosecutions and deportations increased under President Obama during fiscal year 2009. Obama sent a video message to the rally, and in it he reaffirmed his commitment to work for change this year. Members of Congress took to the stage to pressure him to do just that. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey.
The fruit that we had for breakfast this morning was probably picked by the callous hand and bent back of an immigrant worker. The chicken we had for dinner last night was probably picked up by the cut-up hands of an immigrant laborer. And if we have a sick one in our family, they are probably being tended to by the warm heart and steady hand of an immigrant aide. We cannot wait to bring them out of the darkness and into the light.
An estimated 11 million people live in the darkness in this country. Erwin is one of them. He's 13. This is why he was out on the mall.
So all immigrants can get paper, and like so we could go out to other places.
He says without legal documentation, he can't go see his family in El Salvador. He says immigrants have a hard time traveling outside the country.
They might get scared, and the police might catch them and they might send them back to where they're from.
Anti-immigration forces were invisible during the massive event, though the Federation for American Immigration Reform held what they call a virtual march, which consisted of online signatures delivered to members of Congress. The group's president, Dan Stein, outlines his vision for immigration reform.
Strong enforcement, secure borders, strong interior enforcement, and a resumption of true immigration reforms that will reduce overall levels of immigration.
Immigrant rights advocates agree with those ideals, but when they talk about comprehensive reform, that also includes a path to citizenship for people, like Irwin, who are here without legal status. Anti-immigrant groups call this amnesty and say it rewards people for breaking the country's immigration laws. A bill introduced last year in the House would provide a pathway to citizenship, but major obstacles remain for reform, including sharp disagreements about whether or not to include a guest worker program and trepidation about tackling another hot-button issue so close to the midterm elections. Scott Brown's Senate victory in Massachusetts, taking the seat of immigrant champion Teddy Kennedy, further dampened the chances for reform this year. Additionally, a bipartisan effort in the Senate might be unraveling. Senators Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham had been making some progress on the Senate's version of the bill, but on Friday, Graham said if the health care bill passed, immigration reform is dead, for this year at least. Still, as tens of thousands of people promised Sunday, they won't let prospects for reform slip away without a fight. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Iraq's Electoral Commission has rejected calls for a manual recount of parliamentary elections held 2 weeks ago. The country's president called for a recount over the weekend, saying that it was necessary to preclude any doubt or misunderstanding about the results. On Saturday, current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, whose State of Law coalition slightly trails the Iraqi alliance in results, also called for a manual recount. Large numbers of voters went to the polls on March 7th, despite violence throughout the region. International observers have mostly called the elections free and fair. However, the charges have opened the possibility of a long and contentious period, even after full results that are expected to be released the end of this week. To take a deeper look at the various coalitions vying for power and what they could bring to the leadership, we're joined by Raed Jarar. He's a senior fellow on the Middle East at Peace Action, a nationwide grassroots peace organization, and he's been following the latest results. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
First, let's take a look at the coalition led by former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, that's the Iraqi Alliance. In most recent tallies, they are slightly in the lead. Alawi is Shia, but he's pushed for national identity over sectarian divides. His coalition also had big gains in Sunni provinces. What does his coalition pledge to bring?
Yeah, you are right. Despite the fact that Dr. Alawi happened to be a Shia, he is against introducing himself as a Shiite. He prefers to be introduced as an Iraqi. And I think this is one of the major issues that Al-Iraqi coalition is bringing to the table. Whether the leaders of Al-Iraqi were Sunnis or Shiites, seculars or religious, Christian or Muslim or other, they all try to introduce themselves as Iraqis first. And they are trying to bring Iraq back to a time where sectarian and ethnic divisions are not main political leading forces.
I see. And how does that differ with current Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's the State of Law coalition?
It's not very much different. They are actually close to each other. Mr. al-Maliki's coalition is actually closer to being a nationalist than Dr. Alawi, but there are still some religious and some sectarian overtones to his speeches and to his coalition's agenda. Overall, when Iraqis look at the choices, I think al-Maliki and Alawi are very close to each other, but al-Iraqiya is definitely the most anti-sectarian and the most nationalist list out there that is trying to end any sectarian politics in the country.
And those two are the leading coalitions at this point in the vote tally. Another figure that has emerged lately is President Jalal Talabani. He's the one who called for a recount on Sunday. The president is mostly a ceremonial position, but Talabani is from the Kurdish region, and the oil-rich city of Kirkuk is still in dispute. Alawi has called for Kirkuk to come under Baghdad control, but with extra powers to the local government. What is the influence of the Kurdistan Alliance in this process?
The two Kurdish ruling parties actually lost a lot of their power and authority. They lost a province within Kurdistan, Sulaymaniyah, to another new coalition called Turan, and they lost Kirkuk to Al-Iraqiyya coalition, and they lost Mosul or Nineveh to Al-Iraqiyya coalition as well. So they did not do well in the Iraqi election. Despite the fact that Mr. Talabani is the president, his influence over the election is very limited. There were some rumors last week that he has called for a complete recount, but today there were new statements put in the press saying that he's just has asked for recount in a very limited number of cities, very limited number of electoral centers. So that will not change the entire process.
I see. So what he's calling for is a limited recount in only certain parts.
Correct.
I see. Now, the Electoral Commission has said that they will release final results this Friday. But even with a majority, parliamentary seats are awarded province by province. So when are we likely to see a more definitive outcome?
So we are still very much towards the beginning of the process. After the election results come out at the end of this week, we will know who's the number one coalition and who are the other major coalitions. And then they will have to vote for a speaker of the Iraqi parliament, and then they will have to vote for a president who in his turn assigns the leader of the biggest bloc to be the prime minister. And this will take a very long time, and there are major, major threats to the process. I am very concerned, and we might see some major obstacles to a peaceful handover to authority. So my point is that there is still a lot that will be coming in the upcoming weeks. So by the declaration of the winner this week, that will not be the end of the electoral process.
Raed Jarar is a senior fellow on the Middle East at Peace Action, a nationwide grassroots peace organization. He's also one of the first Iraqi bloggers, and he grew up in Baghdad. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
For 10 years, a group of Rastafarian men in Virginia prisons have been segregated from the rest of the population. A State Department of Corrections grooming policy enacted in 1999 is the basis for the confinement. The policy limits the length inmates can grow their hair and beards, and Rastas believe their hair should never be cut. An ACLU case in 2005 tried to challenge the policy. However, the state agreed with the DOC, saying it is a matter of security. Brad Kuttner has the story.
Sister Janet Taylor, or Queen Nzinga as she is known to those she has helped behind bars, is a community activist with a special interest in prison reform. She has also been a Rastafarian for 30 years.
There is a vow, which is what you take when you become a Rasta, that that you're not going to put a razor upon your face or your head.
Virginia's Department of Corrections grooming policy requires near clean shaven heads and faces, which violates the religious customs of Rastafarians and other faiths, for example Hasidic Jews, who often do not shave their beards and wear peyotes or long side curls. The Virginia Corrections Department could not confirm how many prisoners they're segregating for violating the grooming policy. But one prisoner, Elton Williams, told the Richmond Times-Dispatch in a December 2009 letter that there were 9 Rastafarians in segregation. Larry Traylor, head of communications for the Virginia Department of Corrections, declined to be taped for this story, but in an email stated the DOC, quote, strives to provide offenders with the opportunity for personal growth by developing a sense of self-respect and respect for others through each offender's appearance, attire, grooming, and hygiene. He added the grooming policy also facilitates identification of prisoners and promotes safety, security, and sanitation. but many say the policy is misguided and inhumane, including Rastafarian and activist Janet Taylor.
You're Rasta, your locks are holy. So if it's about grooming your hair and the hygiene, how did that become interpreted as the length of a person's hair? So, you know, we get into semantics and, you know, as opposed to interpretation.
In segregation, prisoners have little interaction with other people and are denied access to education and vocational training. They are also denied so-called good time, which helps reduce their sentences. In a letter to the local newspaper, another prisoner, Alan McRae, said being in segregation has created a deep-rooted bitterness, frustration, and depression. He described his days as a repetitive cycle of stress and frustration. McRae is serving a 20-year sentence for drug possession. Prisoners have tried to fight the policy. In 2004, McRae sued the state of Virginia, challenging the constitutionality of segregating prisoners based on their hair length. ACLU attorney Rebecca Glenberg was part of the legal team representing McRae.
From the beginning, it seemed outrageous to us that the Department of Corrections would impose these stringent requirements on inmates' hair and beards, which really did not seem to us to have any legitimate purpose and really unnecessarily restricted their right to religious expression.
The ACLU entered the courtroom thinking the case would speak for itself. Glenberg said even the Federal Bureau of Prisons doesn't restrict hair growth and beard length as harshly as Virginia. She detailed the argument used by the Virginia DOC.
There were three arguments. One was that long hair and beards was a hygiene problem. Second, that the hair and beards could be used to hide contraband. And third, that the hair and beards could be used to disguise inmates' appearance so that it would make it easier for them to escape. But the department was able to provide almost no examples of any of these things happening. They presented one example from years earlier about an inmate whose hair or beard had become infested with spiders or something of the sort, and perhaps one example of contraband being hidden, but really very few examples and none that were at all recent.
The first ACLU case went to the district court in Richmond. They lost and appealed to the 4th District. The ACLU case argued the state violated the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000. Eric Rosbach of the legal aid group, the Beckett Fund, says the law was used in a 2001 Madison v. Ritter case. Ira Ritter claimed to be a member of the Church of God and Saints of Christ. Its members adhere to dietary laws and Hebrew scriptures. He asked for such accommodation and was denied.
The prison administrators say, well, we can't give that to you because usually they say that it would affect security. So they have to prove that they have the compelling governmental interest of prison security, and they also have to prove that they're using the least restrictive means available to them that causes the least effect on religious exercise.
In the Ritter case, the court ruled in favor of the prison. Both Rosbach and Glenberg say Virginia is no friend to prisoners' rights, and the McRae case was to be no exception. Before a bench judge with no jury, the Fourth Circuit Court ruled in favor of the Virginia Department of Corrections. Since then, Sister Janet Taylor maintains contact with the segregated prisoners through letters and occasional phone calls.
For my purposes, there's a difference between retributive punishment and restorative punishment, and I somewhat favor the restorative. But I would think after 10 years, that would be a definitive enough time to say, oh, well, they must be really serious about their religion if they were willing to withstand this abuse.
According to the ACLU, there's no other legal challenges pending for the Virginia Rastafarians in segregation. And short of new evidence supporting the constitutional arguments, the policy stands as is. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.